My name is Peg Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship, I've been sober since February the 4th, 1964, and I'm very grateful for that. Oh, I'm really glad to be here. I'm really glad to be anywhere, really. I want to thank Morris so much. He's such a sweet guy. Maybe some of you don't think he is, but I think he's a sweet guy. I mean, he's been so unfailingly kind to me through the years. He really is a good guy. And if you think it's easy to put on one of these conferences with, you know, the only trouble with Alcoholics Anonymous is it's full of alcoholics. And you know, I don't know about you, but there's a lot of mood-changing people in my group. They can change my mood overnight, or in a minute. You know, what did he look at me like that for? What a old Mr. on and on and on, you know. All he does is go on and on and on about the same things. You know, they can change my mood right away, and I came in a good mood. But when I leave the meeting, I always leave in a better mood anyway, because meetings always end about gratitude. I mean, no matter what the subject starts out to be, it ends in always about gratitude, because we of all people, and me of all people, should not be here. I should not be here. I should be locked up someplace, locked up or covered up or barred up. You know, I shouldn't be here. And I know some of you in the audience, and you shouldn't be here either, because all we had to do to get here, just think about this. This is Ocean City, Maryland. We are sitting in a beautiful convention center where they would have thrown out a bunch of us a long time ago. But we'd have never made it in the door here. We'd have been throwing up in those pots out in front, you know, and the cops would be coming from the police station and taking us down to the local pokey. You know, here we are, and all we had to do to get to come on this whole week-long vacation was be massive failures. We just had to fail, you know. And isn't it great? Because the more you fail, the more we love you. I mean, it's like, I've been in jail 4 times. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Will you marry me? You know. You know, I like those bad boys. Those bad boys with the chains and the tat. I mean, I am not like that. I was not raised like that, but I like those bad boys. With all the beard and everything. I like Tiny. I mean, Tiny was a bad boy. I mean, he was whatever his real name is, Greg. I mean, I like Tiny because he has total recall. And if I need to know something, I just go ask Tiny. And he'll come up with it. If it takes him all weekend, he'll come up with it. Anyway, so I'm really glad to be here. Everybody has treated me so nicely. And I get to come away with my husband. My mother has Alzheimer's, and I can't leave her for too long at least I feel I can't, because it seems to me that as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a person who goes to meetings, I'm a meeting maker. I mean, I go to meetings all the time. It seems to me that my responsibility, if I can, even though she really has no one and is trapped in the prison of Alzheimer's, that I am a key for her. She knows me, and I'm responsible for maintaining some kind of link with any kind of sanity that she has left. And if I don't go see her pretty much every day, she loses touch with reality. And you know what? She saw me through the worst of my drinking, and I can see her through the worst of her Alzheimer's. So I shouldn't be here. I would not be a person that would mix with us. I was a loner, a mean little kid, just mean as a snake. I was born with the Tasmanian devil in me. You know, I just felt like, you know, I wouldn't move, but I just felt like I was running around inside, squinty-eyed, you know, just shooting people. You know, I just get somebody I didn't like, and I just, you know, just a little out of, I was like I was in a little tank, and I rolled around on my little treads and took pot shots at people, and I like to beat people up, boys. I didn't like to beat girls up. Because I really didn't like girls. I like boys a lot better because you could push them around when you're a girl. And then if you beat them up and you know, they couldn't come after you and say, girls don't fight. And I'd say, well, he pushed me or whatever. And, you know, I'd cry a little or whatever and they'd let me go. But boys aren't supposed to pick on girls, so they couldn't hit me back was the main thing, although they did because that's the way I was. And so I was a mean little kid. I was an active little kid. My father, who died last year, who was truly one of my heroes, I've had an interesting couple of years. My father died. He was probably the biggest hero outside some of the people I know in Alcoholics Anonymous. He died last year, and I was with him when he died. And he died. He just slid away, and he was 95, and he'd had enough, and he quit eating, and he didn't die of anything specific. He just simply slid away, and I was there when he was gone, and he was peaceful. The hardest part was for when they came and took the body out of the house. I just, because he was such a part of my life, and it was so hard to see that corporal part of him leave, although I knew he had sailed away before. But I did learn new things from that, from hospice and that sort of thing. So I've had a kind of an interesting couple of years, but at any rate, it's wonderful to be here, and it's wonderful to be in your presence, and I hope I can add a little bit of something to it. Being this mean little kid, I grew up to be a relatively mean adult. certainly a mean teenager, but very bright and somewhat manipulative, and I loved to drink. That was just the best thing that... I was a skinny kid, you know, just a kind of, I had no ends, I had no waist, I had no hips, I had no boobs. I was just straight up and down, you know, and all these girls were growing boobs and twitching, you know how girls twitch. You know, you see newcomer girls walk across the front of the meeting, you know, and they kind of twitch like this. Well, you know, I never learned how to twitch. I never learned how to wiggle. I just felt it was really kind of stupid. But I really did want to have boobs of some sort, and when I, because I really didn't, I just was like a couple of fried eggs on the sidewalk, you know, that's about what it was, about what it is today, kids, let me tell you. Dick didn't marry me for my good looks, I'll tell you that. Anyway, when I drank, you know, I could just feel the hips go in. I mean, just, oh, waist would dip in, you know, and my hips would flare out and my boobs would grow, you know, just the magic, just like Dolly Parton, you know, and I could twitch and move, and I ended up in the backseat of cars with guys like Bob Van Orden. I wanted to throw up on, you know. I didn't know what I was doing, a bad mistake in judgment, you know, and I'd start over the next day, you know. But the good part of drinking was really good, because when I first drank, it did everything for me I wanted it to do. I mean, it just, God, it just went down. It just, you look better. I mean, when I drank, you improved. You know what I'm saying? It's just like you improved. And when I drank, the world was an easy place to be. When I drank, my hair got curly. My personality was sunny. I knew truth. You know, I felt it. I had this really spiritual feeling, which is true because we drink spirits and it's in spiritu, and so we have an in spiritu feeling, which is we're drunk, you know, but we're spiritual, you know, we're very spiritual at that point. Certainly I was. And I love the way, because what is wrong with me is I have a God-shaped hole in myself. It's a God-shaped hole that I had from the time I was the Tasmanian devil. You know, just from the beginning, there was this God-shaped hole. And I didn't know that. I wouldn't have any more told you that. I just knew I felt different. And when I drank, I didn't. I felt great. I felt empowered. I just, you know, I could take on the world. And but the more that I drank, the longer that I drank, the more that I kept trying to get that. Do you remember that feeling you had when you first drank? Where it just your hair would twizzle, you know, it would just I'd get chill bumps on my arms. And it just slid down inside and just boom, made me feel wonderful. Oh, remember that feeling? I wanted that all the time. And the longer I drank, the more it took for me to get that feeling. And as a result, you know, I was not a panty waist drinker. I drank with the man. I was drinking, when I got sober, I was drinking a quart of vodka a day. And I was upright. I was still walking drinking a quart of vodka a day. Now, did I make any sense? No. Did I remember you? No. Did I know where I was? No. Did I remember what I had done? I didn't particularly want to. But did I drink that much? You bet I did. And what happened to me is what happens to all of us. My drinker broke. It's just that simple. I got to the point where, and what happens? What I drank for is what I lost. I drank for courage, and I became afraid. I drank for grace and I became clumsy. I drank for spiritual feelings and I was in hell. You know, I don't think we actually ever really get to heaven, not in my day, not in the living time that I have, but I think we back away from hell. Because when I was drinking, that was my hell. That was a hell. And I you know, I'm a funny person. I lost my sense of humor. I inherited that from my mom and dad, especially my dad. And I had lost that sense of humor. Nothing was funny. Everything was gray. It was all depressing. Nothing was ever going to happen for me. And, you know, and I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I recovered my sense of humor, which has, you know, if I can laugh at something, it simply makes me right-sized. It puts me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I can look at myself and laugh at myself, that's when I begin to grow. When I can take myself as a child of God, but a person who's right-sized in this room and not all blown up, you know, like I, without my ego, I am so comfortable. And it's taken, I mean, 42 years. It's taken me 42 years to be right-sized this evening with you. And, you know, I love to drink. I loved everything about it. And in the beginning was wonderful, and then I began to have some trouble. I mean, there was some trouble. One time I thought it was a good idea to swim, well, not one time, many times, but this particular time I was swimming naked in Lake Worth, outside of Fort Worth, with two girlfriends, and some of our friends stole our clothes and threw them in the bushes, and we thought it was very funny because we were drunk, And we got out, and all they left us were our shoes. And there were just little shoes lined up along the shore. So we got into our shoes. We're all drunk, laughing, walking up the gravel road, and here comes the cops, you know, shining them. You know, they have the spotlight on the side of the car, you know. Here's this, you know, three drunken teenagers, you know, coming down the road thinking we're so cool, you know, with our totally naked. And they gave us, you know, raincoats and stuff, and we looked for our clothes, and we found our clothes, but they took us home. They didn't put us in jail. They took us right home. That's what they did in those days. And my father came to pick me up, and he didn't speak to me for days afterwards. He gave me that look that the guy last night was talking about. I thought that was so wonderful what he said last night. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I think his name was Greg. But he was just wonderful, because that look, you know, when they look at us like that, and my dad gave me that look. And for years, my dad had always said to me, what, and this is my dad's language, please, what the hell is wrong with you? What the hell is wrong with you? You know, and it didn't matter. When I was little, what the hell's wrong with you? When I was bigger, what the hell's wrong with you? I'm 22 years old. What the hell is wrong with you? You know, he could not figure out. And in my purse, I have a picture. I had a doll when I was little. And this is, you know, it has nothing to do with anything really. But this doll I named Muggsy. That's an indicator somehow, you know, because, you know, most of them, they name their dolls Babies or Betsy or Rosie or some nice name. But I named it Muggsy after a gangster. And my dad was a surgeon, so I operated on this doll all the time. And she had soft skin, so I would slit her open and give her, you know, tonsillectomies and mastectomies and appendectomies, and my favorite was the hemorrhoidectomy. You know, I sliced up her butt, and then I'd stitch her up. My mother would help me stitch her up with black thread. And one day I was getting picked on because I was a great one for holding resentments for years, and which was a whole, you know, yeah, I had a lot of work to do when I got sober. But I was mad because I was being made to take a nap or something, and I pried the screen off my window and threw the doll out the window. And I got worried, and I had to come up with a cover story. I was probably 5 years old. And my mother finally, about 3 days later, she said, "Where's Muggsy?" And I said, "She became depressed." Over her ill health, and she committed suicide. Now, I'm 5 years old. Come on. My mother still remembers that. She said, well, you know, and I have a picture. I have the only photographic record of Muggsy. And my sister and I are sitting in these little lawn chairs, and I have Muggsy by the neck, with just the head showing up here, and my sister's sitting in the other little lawn chair looking at me like, what the hell's wrong with you, you know? And so then I had that time in there where it was starting to have a little bit of trouble. You know, there was drinking and there was a little trouble, and I went to Europe to school. I was very gifted in languages, and so I started learning languages, French and German and Russian and Spanish and, you know, Portuguese and other things like that. And I had to go over to this interpreter school in Paris to further this, and which was wonderful because I could speak all of them with such fluency when I was drunk, just totally drunk, because it takes away your inhibitions and you could just, and you don't even care. You know, you don't care whether you make a mistake or anything. And so some more trouble started happening over there, and I left this big celebration with a Scotsman, and the last thing I remember is flipping up the back of his kilt to see if he had on any underwear, you know. And a couple of years ago, I went to Scotland with Dick and to a convention, and they had pipers there, and one of the Scotsmen came, they were teasing me, and they go, Don't give her any sticks. Don't give her any sticks, you know, because they'd heard about my flipping up the back of this guy's kilt. And then I went out of a blackout at that time, and I came out again, and I'm with an Italian. I've been speaking English. Now I'm speaking Italian with Giorgio. And we're in a cemetery, and it's raining, and I am apparently have done something really terrible because he says I should go to Mass the next day. And I go to Mass the next day, and he believes I should do confession and this kind of thing, and they're getting up and down, and they're waving stuff, and there's smoke, and there's guys with gowns on and stuff, and people are up and down and up and down, and I'm just sick. I mean, I am sick because I'm not Catholic. I mean, I have no idea what they're doing. I have no idea what I've done. And so I'm getting more trouble, you know. So what does an intelligent alcoholic do? I just don't go around people. I stay at home. I drink at home. I go out, I work, I come back, I drink. I go out, I work, I come back, I drink. And I ended up living with my parents in Washington, D.C., on the third floor of a townhouse there where my father was a big bucky muck. And they would have people over to the house, and they would suggest to me that I stay in the attic because I was drinking a quart of vodka a day by then, and I was not good company. I had somehow... There's a calendar over there that has this little baby bear hanging in a tree, and it says, I tried to contain myself, but I escaped. And that's me, you know, because I tried to contain myself, and I would escape from this attic once in a while. And I got downstairs and was arguing bowling averages with an admiral. And I hadn't been bowling since the senior year in high school, and I never was much of a bowler, so I didn't know anything about it, and they were embarrassed, and, you know, I just hid out, and I just drank more and more and more. And my sister finally said to me, you look road hard and put up wet, which is a horse term, I understand, and let's frost your hair. Okay. Now, my brother and sister and I we're all close because we moved a lot. And she sits me down on this shower, puts this shower curtain thing around me, pulls hair through this shower cap with holes in it, and puts this stuff on my hair. And in a few minutes, she goes, oh, something is wrong. Let me try again. So she puts some more on. She says, I don't know what's wrong, but there's been some chemical reaction, you know. And I tell you, if you drink the way that I drank, any of you women in the audience have tried to put stuff on your hair when you're drinking like I drank, because I was personally 90 proof. My blood was 90 proof. My hair turned bright bozo orange. I mean, there were big... I looked like a hyena, you know. I just had these enormous streaks of bright orange. And then it broke off, it fell out, it itched, you know. So I was walking around like this, and I scratched my hair, scratched my head till it bled because I'm, you know, compulsive about that kind of thing. And... I mean, I just looked horrible. I mean, my fingernails were all ridged. My liver was distended. I had cirrhosis of the liver. My blood pressure was 280 over 140, and I was 25 years old. I mean, I was a bad drunk. I'm a bad drunk. I drink. That's what I do. I drink. That's my whole life. And I couldn't work by then. The last job I had was this little drunken receptionist. I was a drunken receptionist in Washington, D.C., for the American Speech and Hearing Association. And I'll tell you something, they were a lobbying outfit, and my amends through the years has been that I arrange all the signing done in our meetings because I owe these people amends because I was the drunken receptionist in charge of counting the votes of an election. And these paper ballots would come in for their next board of directors, and I didn't like this one guy getting all the votes. So I took the votes from that guy and gave them to a guy whose name I liked better. I rigged that election. And, you know, this doctor was on the amends list. I had to go back to him after I got sober, make an appointment with him, go into his office and tell him what I had done, tell him I was in AA and that my sponsor was making me do this, you know, these things. And I described what I'd done, how I'd rigged the election, and he laughed, and he said, "You see this new building we're sitting in today?" He said, "That board of directors were the ones that raised the money for it. You did good." And he said, "I don't know what you did, but whoever you picked must have been the guy because this is why they raised the money to get this building." So it turned out good, but not most of the time that kind of stuff never does, but that happened to turn out well. That was towards the end of my drinking, and I just absolutely, one day, I was given the greatest gift, and I hope, oh my God, I hope that you're given this gift, and that is the gift of desperation. The gift of desperation is the best gift that I would have ever been given, because it made me willing to take actions on stuff that I didn't believe. I did, first of all, for the first time in my life, I took direction from somebody. I never in the world would take direction from somebody. Nobody was going to tell me what to do. And, you know, I was in a meeting. There was a newcomer there not very long ago, 2 weeks ago. And he said something that was so profound. He said, "If it weren't for AA, I would be me." Now, think about that. What if you were who you were right now? There would be 12 or 15 fist fights out here before this thing was over. Somebody would be taking somebody out the door to the nearest motel, at least one. If we were who we were, we are not what we think. We are what we do. And that's what people judge us by. But it's also an ultimate judgment of ourselves. What do I do? And I was given that gift of desperation, and I was willing to do whatever. Now, did I do it nicely? No. Did I do it with good spirit? No. My sponsor, you know, she made me mad in the first few weeks that I had her. Her name was Jane Holler, the late, great Jane Holler, in Washington, D.C., and she said, "What's the matter with you?" I said, "Nothing," with the usual newcomer honesty, you know, "nothing." And she said, "You're mad at me, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, you hurt my feelings, and I'm a sensitive alcoholic." And she said, "You're not a sensitive alcoholic, you're a touchy bitch." Sorry, Morris, but it was what Jane said. And she was right. I was. I didn't care about you. I cared about me. She made me sit up in the very front row. And the reason she made me sit in the front row is because I thought it was because if I tried to get up and leave the meeting, she would trip me. You know, I thought it was a sponsor trick or something, that they would just keep you up there like, I don't know, like birds or something. But no, it was because she wanted me to be present in the room. Because sometimes, you know, when you're new especially, you want to count ceiling tiles, you know, when Mr. On and On is talking, you know. You want to look at him, you know, you're sure that that's God's will for you, you know. You know, you count the hairs on the guy's head in front of you. You know, you don't pay attention. I didn't pay attention. I mean, I was just lucky to be there, you know, And it took me a year and a half or 2 years before I could get it together. And so she had me in that front row so I could pay attention. And I've been sitting in that front row ever since. Because I don't care if you call it superstition or what, but I have taken those actions all those years, and by golly, in February I'll celebrate 43 years. I'm not going to change that. That's for you, I'll tell you. It's for you because, you know, if it weren't for AA, I'd be me, you know, and that's the problem. She did for me those things that I have. I do now what I did in the beginning. I do now what I did. She said, go be greeter. I said, I don't want to be greeter. She said, I didn't ask you if you wanted to be greeter. I said, go be greeter. Go greet somebody. Stick out your hand for the first time in your selfish and self-centered life. You know, when your sponsor talks to you, when she's saying things like that, doesn't it sound like she said, rah, 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 doesn't it sound like that? Rah, 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 rah. Go be greeter. Well, I was too scared of her not to. I think there's a good thing about a healthy amount of fear in a newcomer. You know, because I went over there and I shook their hands and I'd say things like, and this was it. I said, I don't want to greet people. I don't even like them. She said, I don't care if you like people. Go act like you like them. So I'd go and I'd go, welcome to the friendship group. That was my home group, was the friendship group. And then sooner or later, you know, when they weren't mad at me or didn't get upset with me or anything, I got, so I liked it, you know. So I was, welcome to the friendship group. You have a piece of literature, you know. I was giving people 30 and 40 years sober pieces of literature that, you know, I was just, and, you know, I'm a great believer in this, in expressing the God within. You know, it's a God song. Every single one of you in this audience has a song from God in you. It may be a small lullaby. It may be a sweet song. It may be a wonderful song. Mine happens to be a football song. Mine happens to be, you know, da 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 da, you know, whatever it is. I love football, you know, and whatever your song is, I think that Alcoholics Anonymous allows me to do what it is that I have, allows me to sing my song. It allows me to express the God within. And you have that ability too. And that's why I get so excited. I'm going to be greeter in September. When I go home, I get my greeter badge. And I'm going to be greeter all of September in my home group. And I will greet people. I will drag people down to get to greet them. You know, and I always say to them, don't be selfish and self-centered. Let me greet you. It's the best thing you can do for me. I need to get out of myself, you know. And one time we had the best greeting committee. We had Manny, who was at work release out of the penitentiary. He had been detained unexpectedly on a trip across Nebraska from California with some foreign substance or other in the car. So he was presently spending 5 to 10 in the penitentiary. He was in our greeter. He was one of our greeters. He was out. They'd go get him from the... If you have a chance to do institution work, this is my plug. Do it. It's great. I do it. I go to the jail meeting every Monday night on a six-week basis. There's never a meeting that's any better because, you know, it just makes me grateful to be sober and to be there. And anyway, Manny was on this. Another little girl had slit her wrists, and she was coming in. We became the best greeter set you ever saw, you know, the most unlikely people in the world, and yet there we were greeting. Next thing my sponsor said, and this is just now, and my sponsor said, go out there in the kitchen and make coffee with Crazy Frank. I mean, wash coffee cups with Crazy Frank. I said, I don't want to wash coffee cups with Crazy Frank. He's crazy. She said, it's okay. Go out. I didn't ask you. He's not going to harm you in a meeting. Go wash coffee cups. So she says, think of something to say to him. Well, he was really tall. So I said, Frank. He said, yep. I said, must be nice for you being so tall. I said, why? I said, because you're a painter, aren't you? He said, yeah. I said, you don't have to use a ladder to paint the ceilings. And he did this. And all of a sudden, I understood. Frank was not crazy. He was misunderstood. And I understood Frank. You know, so we became a wonderful cup washing team. And today, guess what I'm doing today? I am the second set of table over table moppers. I have my rags, which are my rags. I go to the kitchen, I get them wet after the meeting, and I wipe down. We have a meeting on Tuesday night, my home group, which is a meeting of 500 people, and they're messy. I wipe down tables from the front of the room to the back of the room in one set of tables. And I'm sober 42 years. What do I give up? Do I give up the greeting? Do I give up the jail? Do I give up the table wiping? Which one is the one that's keeping me here? What do I know? It's my actions. You judge me by my actions. You don't judge me by my thinking. Do you think I want to stay there every Tuesday night until 10 o'clock wiping down those damn tables? No. I want to go home. I'm 68 years old. I need my rest. But I'm going to wipe those tables because I don't know, but what that isn't what the thing is doing. You know what I'm saying? And if I sponsor you, you will have your turn. Because you know what rolls downhill. And you're going to, you know, these are the suggestions that I was willing to take because I'm desperate. Okay, I'm sober. I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got a sponsor. I'm going through the steps. My father was a very accomplished man. And I had gone to his university, Washington University, in my last year. And I hadn't graduated from Washington University in my last year because I was taken drunk the week of the finals. And I just couldn't get there. So I didn't take the finals in my senior year of college. $5,000 a semester. Oh, cringy thought. So I didn't graduate from college. I remember that put my whole family through a college graduation, and I knew my name wasn't on the list. They all came. They're in the audience. I'm in somebody else's cap and gown. I'm sitting in the audience. We didn't have to go. They just called your name as you know, for your diploma. We didn't have to walk across the stage. And afterwards, I just remember it like it was yesterday. I was walking down this path, and the gown was swinging, touching the gravel on this path. And my dad came up, put his hand under my arm, and he said, "We got to talk." And if I'd been able to be honest at that time, I would have said to him, "Daddy, I would do anything to not disappoint you. But see, I'm an alcoholic, and I drink. And that's what I do. I drink and I hurt people. I drink and I disappoint. I drink and I don't have any integrity. I drink and I am a poor example of a human being. And I'm sorry." But I couldn't say that. But that day in February of 1964, when I was given that gift of desperation, that God-shaped hole began to be filled. And I really believe this, that all of our lives, that we're looking for God, that we're looking for that power greater than, and we, that longing that we have, that's the part in the book that says that separateness, that apartness that we feel is because we miss God. And I sure didn't know that at the time. And I didn't know that for many years. But that day, when that desperation rendered me powerless and hopeless, I hadn't one single more idea. Didn't have a single idea. And I just said, I need help. And my mother, I was drunk, and my mother slipped me some kind of knockout thing, and they folded me in half and put me in the back of a Porsche automobile and drove me out to Melwood Farm in the country outside Washington, D.C., unfolded me on the porch, and I've been sober ever since. And of the people that were in that house, I'm the only one who is still sober. Some of us have died. Some of us died sober. But a lot of us drank again. And when I first started, I said, my name's Peg Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and your fellowship, which I think for the first 5 years, 10 years of my sobriety held me here and holds me here today, because I love many of you and I like a lot of you, and that sure wasn't my character. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship. I have a sponsor today. I've had a sponsor ever since I got sober. I got a sponsor in Nebraska that I had for 27 years who died with her 40-year medallion clutched in her hand, the late, great Jean Mulry. And I have a sponsor today. I need to be accountable to somebody because my magic magnifying mind just gets the best of me sometimes. And so I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. I did what Jane said. I went to meetings. I was of service. I did all of those things. I met and married Dick. He was a newcomer. They were taking bets on how long we'd last, and we've been married 40 years now. So, I mean, it lasted. That's good. First Christmas we were married, we didn't have any money, and we said we weren't going to get each other any presents. Well, I'd come from a relatively affluent family, so I was used to getting stuff. And he came home and he said, I brought you a present. And I said, I got mad because I didn't have anything for him. And he went in the bathroom, and a few seconds later he jumps out of the bathroom and he goes, he's stark naked. He's got a big red bow tied, you know where. And he's singing, here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus. Now I'll tell you what, you can have fun and be sober. And we've had a lot of fun over 40 years. Now, have we had a perfect marriage? Absolutely not. Our senses of humor has saved us more times. Do we take each other's inventory? Of course we do. We're human beings. We're not some kind of strange Ken and Barbie. You know, we have periods of blessed silence at our house at times. And, you know, we're just human beings. We're both members of Alcoholics Anonymous. He is not my sponsor, and I am not his sponsor, and that's a good thing, let me tell you. Yes. To fast forward, I don't want to bore the heck out of you, but I do want to talk about just a few things with some funny stories, because I'm a funny person, and I see things. In a different way. You know, I like to laugh. I think that life, that one of the coincidences, I think we should try to, if we're in a spiritual condition, we're going to see God in everyday things. We're going to see God all around us. We're going to see God in the funny things, because I truly believe this, which is why I love to clap and yell and go to football games, you know, because when people score a touchdown, what do you do? Show me what you do. Yay! okay, this is a physiological fact. You raise your arms up like this, your lungs expand, you give yourself some oxygen, it goes into your heart, goes up into your brain, it gives you some extra energy. But I also think that we're reaching to God. I think that when people get real excited, that's what they do. And I think we should be excited about the fact that God has filled that God-shaped hole in us. It's not like I'm like woo-woo. I'm not woo-woo. I mean, I'm not one of these people that's woo-woo. I'm just not. I'm a bread and butter person. I'm a bread and butter God believer. Do you know what I mean? It's just like practical stuff. And our character defects are the things that block us off from feeling that enthusiasm of that God that's in there, that's in the God, that's filled in the God-shaped hole. For example, I've done many inventories through the years. Well, good heavens, I've been sober 42 years. That's longer than a lot of you have been alive. I have done a lot of things. You know, I mean, I've done a lot of things that I've owed amends for. I've done a lot of things that I have had to, I mean, I have had a big ego. I have been a bleeding deacon. I have been a trusted servant. I have been a bad AA member and a good AA member on the same day sometimes, you know. And, you know, I tried to contain myself, but I escaped. You know, I mean, it's like, that's the story of my life. I try to contain myself and I escape. But what I have to escape with now is, you know, I'm like a tube of toothpaste. Whatever is in me, if you squeeze me, that's going to come out. You know, it's just, you know, it's like a tube of toothpaste. If I'm happy and I'm God-filled and I'm full of enthusiasm and joy and helping others and really hitting it, you know, going in there and pitching it to newcomers and stuff, what you're going to get is the best of me. And if I'm resentful and sour and, you know, not saying my third step prayer, seventh step prayer, and, oh, poor me, pooey on you, you know, that kind of thing. If I'm like that, that's what you're going to get when you squeeze me. Well, I'd rather be going, yay, than I would be going, ugh. I mean, who wouldn't? Which is why I like to jump around a lot, you know, because I think this is what I'm supposed to do. I mean, not this, but I mean, be sober and do what I do is what I'm supposed to do. We're given a gift, and that gift is alcoholism and the recovery from it. And if we don't tell our faces that we have recovered from this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, how can anyone tell? If we sit there like this and say, I'm so happy to be sober. I mean, have you been to some meetings that I like to call the gray tunnel of life meetings where people are like this and I think, and they say, if you want what we have, and I'd say, no, I don't want what you have. No, I don't want what you have. I want happy, joyous, and free, not glum and dumb and self-centered. You know, I want to have that. And if I'm going to have that, then I have to do what I do. Okay, so I've done many inventories, and I have lots of character defects. And I'm going to talk just about a few of them, and then we'll be done. And an experience I had recently. I got afraid to fly. Well, I fly a lot. That's a problem. Now, I'm not talking about afraid. I'm talking about fear, where, you know, you got to have all these things, touch the airplane, you know, which seat do you sit in, help the pilot fly the plane, you know, that every bump is, oh, you know, that sort of thing. So I'm going to Kansas City, down to Fayetteville, or to Little Rock, Arkansas. I get down to Kansas City, try to land in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and it is the roughest flight I have been on for a long time. Little plane, tiny plane, looks like a dragonfly. They balance us in this plane because they know it's going to put us on other sides of the airplane, so I know it's going to be rough. We're coming in to land Fayetteville, ice all over the runway. Everything's on. I'm praying. I'll never swear again from the podium. I'll cook Dick dinner every night. I promise you. I mean, I am such a fair weather Christian, you know, and I'm laying this out. It's like Red Fox, you know, Red Fox. Remember Red Fox? I'm coming. So I'm praying and praying. Flights, it's up like this. The pilot says, well, we didn't make it into Fayetteville. And I thought, no kidding, you know, because we came into land, took off, the stall alarm went off. I'm praying. I hear a rustling behind me. I look back, there's a woman. She's got a brown paper bag. She pulls out a bottle of pop-off vodka, takes the lid off, and takes a big slug out of it, and I felt better. Now, God sent me that woman with the bottle of vodka. I could have been mad. I could have felt sorry for myself. All I saw was, God sent me that woman. You're going to be okay. Another time I'm in California, I'm scared. I'm self-centered. I'm talking at this big meeting, 5,000 people, 10,000 eyeballs. I'm on Saturday night. I'm a little girl from Nebraska. What do I know? What am I going to say? I forgot my story. I mean, I'm just so nervous. I'm so self-centered. I'm sitting out watching this thing called Susie the South. It's a play outside. This friend's sitting with me. I found my yellow silk speaking dress. I'm sitting there. Something wet hits my hand. I look up. I think it's going to rain. Nope, not a cloud in the sky. I look down. It's white. My friend sitting next to me goes, a bird has crapped on your back. There was a huge, it was a seagull. It had a piece of fish in it. All of a sudden, I wasn't scared to speak anymore. For some people, birds sing. For me, they crap. I went in there. I brushed out the bits of fish. I went in and told them about the fact that God had sent me a seagull, that he crapped on me to relieve me of the bondage of self. And that's what it does. That's what he does. He relieves us of the bondage of self by that. I'm down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. We go out to dinner. I love the ocean. I run out to look. We're going to this place called the Captain's Table. It's a restaurant, if anybody knows about it. You know about it? Anyway, it's a great restaurant. So I'm real excited to eat. And I look out to the ocean, and they've got this construction light going out there. In the path of this light are millions and millions and millions of seagulls. Just in the light. And they're bobbing around talking to each other. And, you know, seagulls, they're kind of... They don't have much brains, but they're fun to watch, you know. And so I was fascinated. So when I went in, I said to the waitress, what's with the seagulls? She said, we don't know, but we think it's the light. Of course it's. What are we doing here? We're sitting in the light. We have been given the light. Look at this. Our God-shaped hole is filled. We have been given the light. He has taken away from us many of the barriers to sobriety. Many of those character defects. Are we going to have to keep doing? I'm an alcoholic who suffers from alcoholism, not alcoholism. I need to keep doing. If you like everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're not going to enough meetings. But we have to go to meetings to find out what happens to people who don't go to meetings. I'm a meeting maker. I'm a sponsorer. I am sponsored. I love this program. I love the prayers in it. I love having daily meditation. It gets me ready for the day. I love to say those prayers because I tell you, as soon as I start a prayer, a peace comes over me that gives me 30 seconds of respite from myself. Now, I want to tell you just two more things, really, and I hope that it hasn't seemed so long for you. I have always loved foxes. I have always seen God in wild animals. I love going to Alaska because, you know, you can see all kinds of moose and bear and all kinds of stuff. There's a little baby bear hung up in a tree over in that